Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Several months ago, one of our listeners sent me some information. It said, George, you've got to do a story on the Dyatlov Pass incident. And I went, what's that? Well, he went on to explain a little bit more. You are going to hear one incredible story in a moment. It might chill you when you hear it. It's absolutely riveting. Donnie Eichar, of course, will join us in a second, author of Dead Mountain, and also a pretty acclaimed director and producer in his own right, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. First of all, let me tell you a little bit about Donnie Eichar. He's an acclaimed director, film producer of films, televisions, music videos. He's a Florida native, brought up amongst a family of storytellers, and his most recent work before authoring Dead Mountain, of course, could be seen on MTV's groundbreaking documentary series, The Buried Life. Donnie has produced 18 episodes at least, with the cast achieving their goals of playing basketball with President Obama, delivering a baby, you name it. And welcome. Donnie, how are you?
I'm good, George. How are you?
I'm looking forward to this. It's an amazing, amazing story. But tell me a little bit more about you before we get into it. How'd you get into the business?
Well, you know, I grew up in Florida and moved out to California mainly to surf, and I ended up doing some acting stuff and realized I wanted to be in back of the camera, so I went to film school and I started making documentaries.
And you started making good documentaries. A lot of people started taking notice, and here you are.
And here I am. Somehow I ended up caught in the Dyatlov Pass incident.
This is an amazing story, Donnie. I mean, it's chilling. Part of me wants to say, all right, natural causes, we'll get into all of this, but there's something else going on here. But you wrote the book Dead Mountain. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, it's a Russian mystery that's confounded investigators and inspired speculation for over 50 years. In January 1959, at the height of the Cold War, a group of Russian hikers, they set out on an expedition to the northern Ural Mountains, and one hiker named Yuri Yudin was forced to turn back early due to illness, and he was unaware that would be the last time he would see his friends alive.
There were, what, nine hikers that ended up dying out there?
There were. And so they never returned. So after 2 weeks without word from the hikers, a search team was set out to investigate their disappearance. And when the investigators found the camp, the hiker's tent was discovered to be cut from the inside. And then they found the hiker's belongings inside the tent, completely left undisturbed. And their bodies were found nearly a mile away, insufficiently clothed. Most had no shoes on. Some had violent injuries with fractured skulls and ribs. So it was a pretty compelling thing that the investigators found there.
Didn't one of the hiker skiers even have their tongue missing? Was that a rumor or was that true?
It was true. Yes, one of the female hikers.
I mean, just bizarre. Now, some doctors, Donnie, will say, and you know this, that when you're in extreme weather, you can go a little kooky. Mm-hmm. And one of the symptoms of that is you start doing strange things. Actually, in cold weather, you take your clothes off in some cases and run around naked because of the cold has gotten to you. But I'm not sure this is what happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just, it's weird.
Well, you know, the hikers, they were very well educated and they were experienced hikers. These weren't just some drunken college students that went off on an expedition. They were really, really experienced. So they were properly prepared for the conditions at hand. They knew what they were stepping into, and they would actually push themselves into uncharted areas in order to test themselves, to test their skills in the wilderness.
Tell me a little bit about the conditions in the Ural Mountains when they were up there.
Well, they were in a really remote area of the northern Ural Mountains, pretty much at the gateway of Siberia. They were in 25 to 30 below zero conditions. So it was quite cold, especially for me coming from Florida, hearing about conditions like that. And now I live in Southern California.
Exactly. It's
hardly imaginable.
And was the terrain rough? Was there a lot of snow there, or was it just frigid cold?
You know, the conditions there can change by the minute. It's frigid. It's extremely remote, which is one of the most dangerous aspects of the area. It's just the remoteness of it. If something happens there, if you break your back, it's, you know, a week before you're going to reach any civilization.
Oh, boy. So they're off. So the 10 ski hikers start, one gets sick. He comes back. I think you ended up, did you talk to him eventually?
I did. You know, that was one of the things that really seized my imagination when I first found this story, is that I learned that there was indeed a surviving hiker, Yuri Yudin, and he was still alive. So I thought, you know, I have to try to reach Yuri Yudin because he's the only one that can tell the story of what actually happened, and he was the last person that saw them. So,
was there any evidence of, you know, heavy snowfall that trapped them, an avalanche or anything like that?
Well, you know, their tent was found in the same place where they had actually set it. It was still set in the snow, so it hadn't moved. There was some snow on top of the tent when they found it, but
which is probably normal out there.
It is, yes. But an avalanche most likely would push the tent down the hill.
So at the camp, the tent was discovered to be cut from the inside, the belongings undisturbed. Now, the cutting from the inside, what does that tell you?
Well, bottom line is there was an incident that occurred that scared them to flee their tent, and it scared a few in the tent to want to flee that quickly, where they actually cut a hole from the inside leading out.
Like they maybe couldn't go out through the doorway passage.
Yeah, you know, something I learned when I was in Russia, we did a test. We set up a tent, and I tried to figure out how quickly I could actually leave the front of the tent. But the thing is,
I assume this was a big tent.
It was a large tent. And the thing is, there's three layers in the front of the tent, so there's actually buttons. So it took me over 3 minutes in complete darkness to undo the buttons and able to get out of the tent as quickly as I wanted to. So it would make sense if something happened that you would want to escape as quickly as possible, you would just cut yourself out of the tent.
And they escape. Many of them with no clothes on, with minimal clothes on, as if, I guess they weren't sleeping with it, with the clothes. Maybe they were in their sleeping bags. Maybe they were warm. So whatever caused them to just cut the tent, run out there, they were panicking.
They were.
Bodies found nearly a mile away. Fractured skulls, ribs. The one we mentioned, tongue was gone. And others, of course, some of the other ones seem to die naturally, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the key things to remember here as well is it was in complete darkness when they exited the tent and they walked down a slope. They were walking in complete darkness. You know, there was, once they were a mile away from the tent, there is no going back because you wouldn't be able to actually find the tent again.
Wasn't there signs of radiation on some of the clothes?
The initial reports from the criminal case showed that there was signs of radiation, but I had somebody study that and draw somewhat of a different conclusion.
Okay.
But, you know, one of the really interesting things about this is I contacted Yuri Kuznetsov, who's the head of the Dyatlov Foundation in Russia, and I had a conversation with him.
And he's the survivor, right?
Yuri Kuznetsov is, he's the head of the Dyatlov Foundation, who holds all the materials And, you know, I called him with the translator and I told him I'm a documentary filmmaker and I'm interested to learn the truth, what happened. And he kind of bounced around the subject and then he finally said, if you want to know the truth, come to Russia. So
he challenged you.
He did. He did. I didn't know if it was a challenge or a summons, but he kind of called me out. So next thing I know, I'm talking to my girlfriend, who was 7.5 months pregnant, and I said, I've got to go to Russia.
Oh, boy.
And she said, go. You have to go now. If you're going to go, you need to go now. So I went.
We're going to get into what you found when you went there. So this case, how did this case come to you initially?
Originally, I was writing another scripted project, and to be quite honest, I was procrastinating, and I happened upon this case, and, you know, it just grabbed me and wouldn't let go, and I just had a really hard time understanding how 50-plus years could pass, and yet they find 9 of these bodies, but they have no understanding still of how they died.
And it seems like they didn't even try to investigate it, or did they?
They did. You know, they did investigate it actually for months. The investigators were out there in pretty harsh conditions, and, you know, they did indeed find all the bodies. It just didn't make sense why they would flee the tent, a perfectly good tent.
So you go to Russia, and you go to, of course, the Etlov Foundation. What did they tell you?
Well, you know, I actually lived at the Etlov Foundation with Yuri Kuznetsov for 3 weeks.
And the survivor was another Yuri, right?
The survivor was indeed another Yuri. And my first trip, I could never find him. He was very elusive and didn't turn up. And you know, the interesting thing about the Russians is I ended up interviewing, you know, friends and family of the hikers, search and rescue teams, but usually I would be interviewed first for 15 to 20 minutes to see if they would let me
in,
interview them.
Basically. Yeah, I could understand.
There was always a level of trust that had to be established because many of the people I was interviewing were, you know, in their mid-60s, early 70s, and, you know, an American over there was a bit odd to them. But what I ended up uncovering was, I thought, pretty extraordinary. It was just a trove of materials from the criminal case files to almost 1,000 search and rescue photos to the hikers' recovered photos from their cameras to their diaries. So it was just a mass amount of materials that was presented to me finally, exclusively, in order to study the case.
Had you not taking the trip, Donnie, do you think you could have still gotten some information?
Well, you know, I spent about 3 weeks exhausting every resource I could online before calling the Dyatlov Foundation because I just was sort of running into dead ends. But absolutely, if I would have not gone to Russia, I was just scraping the surface.
I mean, here you are, film producer, a good one. And a director, did you ever think you'd be doing a book on something like this?
I didn't. You know, I really didn't. I had set out to perhaps make a film, but most importantly, I thought, you know, I want to know the truth as to what happened. And also I wanted to know the story beneath the tragedy. Who were these 9 hikers? And that's something that revealed itself to me by interviewing all the friends and family, mm-hmm. that the hikers were gentlemen adventurers, and they were amateur poets and musicians. And Igor Dyatlov, who was the head of the group, he actually built a telescope to see Sputnik for his family. So there's a whole other story started to emerge that compelled me just as much as the tragedy. I became, you know, just really interested in the hikers themselves.
And most of them were in their mid-20s, weren't they?
They were. They were. Yeah, most of them were pretty young. There was one that was 37. He was the oldest one of the group.
So they're there. They're in their tent. It's nighttime. It's freezing out. What do they have for a heat source? I mean, do they have little bonfires in the tents or something?
Yeah, they have a
kerosene heaters.
No, they have a. It's kind of hard to describe. I actually put one together, but it's a tin wood burning stove that they can flatten out, and they put it together every night, and it's in the middle of the tent. So, believe it or not, it actually gets quite warm.
It kind of radiates, doesn't it?
It does.
So they're in there. Frigid outside. Somewhere something happens to cause them to want to cut the tent from the inside. And they're sure, the investigators are sure it was cut from the inside?
They are. They had the threads actually studied, and that was a big thing in the case.
Okay, the only thing, having been a Boy Scout for a while, which would tell me why you would cut the inside, is because you couldn't go out the front area of the tent. For some reason, something was blocking it or there, and they panicked, and they got out fast.
Or perhaps three or four people were trying to get out the front, and the other people were so desperate to get out the back, they couldn't wait and cut a hole.
Could somebody of the group of nine had gone? Could they have gone crazy? And they were attacking, you know, some of the other members?
I don't think so, because if one person went crazy, there's quite a few other guys there to subdue them. If it were two people or three people, I could understand that.
And you still don't cut the tent from the inside.
Exactly.
That's the strange thing. There were cases of orbs or UFOs in the area, I believe.
There were cases of light orbs seen in the sky, yes.
What other strange things were going on during that time period?
Well, you know, it was the height of the Cold War. So there were quite a few things happening. But that was one of the things that I found pretty intriguing is the light orbs in the sky. So that was one of the things that I went and tackled first to try to figure out the dates of the orbs and what they could be.
What's interesting is they weren't running from an animal, because one, an animal might have caught one or two of them and they would have eaten them. The animals would have eaten the skiers, the hikers.
And there would have been tracks. You know,
There would have been marks on the body, right?
Marks on the body, as well as they found the footprints from the hikers leading down.
Once the family members started to warm up to you, Donnie, what were some of the things that they said? I mean, did any of them suspect something very supernatural that might have happened to these people?
No. You know, the common opinion that I found in interviewing the family members was that it was a government cover-up. You know, from my understanding, they really don't trust the government.
But covering up what?
Well, they thought maybe that the hikers had gone to a secret military site or seen something that they shouldn't have seen. And government officials came out there and somehow set up a scene or covered it up.
But, you know, that doesn't explain. There were no marks on the body. You know, nobody shot them. Nobody stabbed them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really didn't make sense, that theory to me, but that was definitely a common theme when I was talking.
All right, Donnie, hold on. We're going to come back, talk more about this strange case with Donnie Eicher's book, Dead Mountain, The Untold True Story of the Dyatlov Pass Incident. It's a strange one. We'll be back. Well, those of you who watched our television program last week, beyond belief, thank you. It was one of our highest viewerships of the week since this program's been on. So thank you so much. Those of you who would like to take a look at it, you can. 10 days free. Just go to www.beyondbelief.com. I shall be back in a moment with Donnie Eicher as we continue talking about Dead Mountain, this incredible, bizarre story of the Dyatlov Pass incident in Russia. And welcome back. Donnie Eicher is with us, author of Dead Mountain. He's also director and producer as well. Donnie, Did anybody ever talk about that area on the Ural Mountains as being haunted? Did that ever come up?
No. I interviewed the local Manzi tribe that lives in the area. They, in the winter, they just don't go there. There's nothing that lives on the mountain. Actually, that's where the name comes from, Dead Mountain, is that there's just no vegetation. There's nothing that actually lives on the mountain.
So it's pretty remote.
It's very remote. The one thing the Manzi did talk about was they would hear these strange winds that would blow somewhere near the mountain or around the mountain, and it really spooked them. So they just tried to stay away from that area, really.
Howling winds. Mm-hmm. Nothing worse than that. When you talked to Yuri Yudin, how old was he? 60s, 70s?
He was, yeah, mid. I think he was 67.
67.
Mm-hmm.
Has this shattered his life?
Well, you know, when I first met him, I thought he was going to have survivor's guilt. And it was kind of an interesting story. I had been waiting years to meet him and finally found out that he was in the flat below me when I arrived. And I woke up and I go down there to meet him, but I don't have a translator. So we're just sitting there having tea, looking at each other, and the translator's an hour and a half late. And finally, when I could ask him a question, he said, don't you have mysteries in your own country? Which I thought that was kind of funny. In his eyes, he thought it was quite curious that an American would go all the way to Russia to try to find the facts about a mystery he was involved in.
But it seems like he's kind of gotten over it. He's not emotionally distraught over it.
He did get emotional.
He did.
Yeah.
Mm.
After week two of interviewing him, when he started to tell me more about his childhood and growing up with his friends and the Dyatlov hikers, he did get emotional, you know. But when he said goodbye to them for the last time, in his eyes, he didn't know that was going to be the last time that he would ever see them. But I think he does have a little bit of a survivor's guilt, but it was quite an honor for him to tell me, of all people, his story and to fill in the gaps of time mm-hmm. in between the journal entries and all the photos that were taken, because in my eyes, that's a piece of history.
Absolutely.
And, unfortunately, he died a few months after I interviewed him. So the story died there.
So he's gone. They're all gone now.
Yes.
They're all gone. Did he ever come up to with any theories?
Well, he was pretty anti-government. So he seemed to think that the government had something to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Like they stumbled across something.
I think he believed that the hikers perhaps shouldn't have been there, and that
they saw something.
They saw something, some type of missile test or a weapon that they shouldn't have seen, and that they paid a dear price for it.
What if they saw a UFO, and the government just didn't want anyone to know about that? Possible. They did have those orbs in the area.
They did have the orbs, but I found an explanation for them in the book, which actually I even shocked myself.
Was it a missile launch?
It was a missile test.
It was a test.
Yeah.
Did they have a launch site out that way?
They had a launch site near there. Yeah, the orbs were seen on February 17th and March 31st, and the hikers died on the night of March 1st and the 2nd in the morning. So the orbs actually weren't in the air when they died. And that's something that has been a bit misconstrued as well that I uncovered. So it wouldn't have been related.
Donnie, kind of paint us a picture, if you could.
Mm-hmm.
From the moment they go on their hike, how far in did they go? How many days were they gone? And kind of describe what you think might be going on.
From when they left their dorms or from when they arrived?
From when they left the dorms.
Well, you know, the really great thing is they had sort of this motorcycle diaries type journey when they left their dorms. They set off for this great adventure, this expedition, and they visited a school and they went there and they sang songs and recited poetry and told story. And then they stopped at a woodcutting settlement and they stayed up all night. And, you know, they were really big into poetry. They would also memorize hundreds of songs and then go and sing, you know, once they were out in the woods. It was the ultimate escapism. So they had this great journey along the way, and they also stayed in an abandoned geologist site. And that's what's in the book as well. And I think that's, you know, people are aware of the tragedy. They don't know about this whole other story that occurred that I found really amazing.
By tracing their journey, I guess, could you feel like the torment that whatever they were going through was awful?
Well, you know, I had reached a place in researching this investigation where I finally realized I've got to retrace their footsteps.
Right.
Because it hasn't been done yet, and how the hell am I going to tell this story if I haven't walked in their shoes and been where they've been? And so that's when I decided we need to do an expedition out there. And I went to a lot of the places that they went to, and in one town called Ivdel, you know, it's, I think, one of the largest gulag cities in all of Russia. And boy, I tell you, I could feel that when we arrived, because we arrived really late at night, and, you know, the prisons are still there up and running, and there's still people that were in the gulags from the Cold War. So the presence of the gulag is still there. I could definitely feel that. And then we went to Ushima, which is a remote Manzi village, and we stayed there with the Manzis, and that served as our base camp going into the northern Ural Mountains.
So what I don't understand is, even if the Soviet Union at the time had troops there and that they saw something, I don't understand how they got killed, how they died. I mean, they obviously were exposed to the elements.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, a couple of fractured skulls and things like that, obviously. But do you think if it happened to be Soviet troops, they kind of like threw them out into the elements, knowing that they would just die within hours?
Well, you know, there would have been footprints from the other Soviet troops.
There was nothing, right?
There was no other footprints other than the hiker's footprints. And in the book, I actually figured out through working with different scientists and survival experts how the hikers died, the exact injuries of why they died. But the remaining big question is, why would 9 hikers, very experienced, leave a perfectly good tent and walk a mile to certain death in 30 below temperatures?
With minimal clothes on.
With minimal clothes, most without shoes. That's the big question.
They went running without shoes?
They had socks on, yes, but, you know, without their proper boots. So that was one thing, you know, that I tested when I was in Russia. I walked for 5 minutes.
Oh, you
just in socks.
Your feet would burn from the cold.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even in panic, where were they running to?
Well, there was a slope outside of the tent that went down into the woods. And I think once they exited the tent, they started to walk down, and then they just kept going forward. But there was obviously something near the tent that they didn't stop halfway. They kept walking.
There was something so horrible to cause them to just flee like that, because they must have known eventually they had to come back and get their clothes or they were going to die from the elements.
Correct. They knew they were walking to certain death walking a mile away from the tent, not properly clothed, without the proper footwear, with no food and no rations.
Let's look at this for a moment, Donnie. So let's assume they're in the tent. It's the wee hours. Maybe they're all asleep. Something comes in the tent. Something so horrible, so scary, that they all just fled. They all took off. To me, that may be the only logical explanation.
Correct.
Something came into that tent to scare them to rush out.
Correct.
And even if it was one Soviet troop peeking in the door, they're not going to all run out that way.
If it were one person, they wouldn't leave.
No, not at all. And again, like you said, no tracks. No tracks at all.
Yeah, these guys are fighters, and it would take a large group of people to get them to walk a mile away from their tent.
Has anybody ever reported Yetis in the area? You know, anything like that?
Once again, if it were something like that, you would see footprints, or you would see marks on the tent, or you would see marks on the body. But I don't think
it wasn't there.
Yeah.
So what is, you know, you were there, you spent time there. What is your conclusion? What do you really think happened to them?
The million-dollar question.
Yeah.
Well, you know, my book comes out today, actually.
Perfect timing for us.
So it's interesting because Lev Ivanov, who was the lead investigator of the case, he investigated this for months. And he said that his final conclusion was an unknown compelling force. That's all he could come up with.
That's obvious, right?
Highly educated man. And it was his only case that went unsolved.
Unknown compelling case.
An unknown compelling force. So that was also something that really grabbed me in this story. And that's when I started to work with different experts in different fields and piece together every possibility that I could. When I came back from the expedition, I put together somewhat of a command center in my garage, which my girlfriend thought I was crazy, but it was this 30-foot wall of a timeline of the hiker's story with all their photos and their journals entries, and then a timeline of the criminal case with the hundreds of photos. And I put together everything that could have possibly happened during that time. And then I started dissecting the top five possibilities till I reached what I think happened. And the interesting thing is, I was actually caught off guard with it, is that this conclusion could have only come with modern science. There would be no way that in 1959 they would have known what happened, because they didn't have the science at the time.
All right. Do you think they went through a portal or something?
I don't. I don't want to give it away.
Let me ask you this. You do not believe the Soviet troops killed them?
I don't think the Soviet troops killed them.
Is it obvious once you look at it?
Not at all.
It's not.
I worked with NOAA, some of the lead scientists there. I went and stayed there for a week and brought them all the materials and all the data and studied it with them. And they helped me to draw a pretty damn good conclusion.
Is there pure evil there?
No, I wouldn't say there's pure evil, but, you know, sometimes tragedies don't necessarily have a villain. They just have a set of unfortunate circumstances.
Natural things?
I think perhaps.
Maybe they got hit by some kind of vortex or something. Some spinning gust of wind that scared them. But it doesn't explain why they'd cut the tent and run out. Maybe were they hallucinating?
No, that's a theory I examined as well. They weren't hallucinating. The thing is it has to be something that affected all nine of them because
Simultaneously.
simultaneously, and they all react in a emergency fight or flight
Yeah.
situation.
Were they on ayahuasca or anything like that?
No,
Nothing like that.
no,
Weren't they
they
not
weren't
poisoned
drinkers.
by food?
Not poisoned by food. They tested the food that was found in the tent, and
A polar bear didn't come rushing into the tent.
no polar bear.
Huh.
The thing is that I had to keep reminding myself that these were very, very skilled hikers. They were actually out there working for their master of sport license. So they were on their fourth level license of training for hiking. So they were
They were good.
very, very good, very educated. And that's, why I'm reiterating that they knew walking a mile into darkness, they knew the risk at hand, absolutely.
Even clothed, how long would it take them to get back to a civilization?
Oh, geez. It wouldn't be possible.
They were too far gone.
Yeah, way too far from civilization.
So it's not like a day or two they would have been able to get back.
No.
Boy, they really went too far, didn't
Yeah,
they?
they were in far and for a purpose. They were actually there to test themselves in the elements. So there was a reason why they were there.
How long were they going to stay there?
They had another 3 or 4 days in their trip, and then they were going to turn
And
around
then
and
they
go
were going to
back.
come back. And the fact that all nine of them died, generally within the same time frame.
Yes.
So,
Yeah, they all died that evening or the morning on the second.
do you think the cause of death was, regardless of how, weather elements?
I do.
Because they were just out there in the extreme weather, no clothes. They just died that way.
Yeah,
The
in
big
the
question
end,
is what scared them enough to do that?
you're going to die from the elements. When I was out there, I was almost had the same temperatures. We were around 25 below zero. And to walk in those conditions is extremely difficult. To walk a mile took me probably an hour and 15 minutes.
Jeez. What would scare you, Donnie, so much to cut the inside of a tent and go running out there with minimal clothes on in sub-zero weather? That's my way of tricking you, by the way.
What would scare me is the unknown. Fearing and hearing the unknown. If I knew where it were a bear, or if I knew it were a fellow human being, that would not scare me to run a mile away.
Would a howling wind that sounded like a monster scare you enough to run out?
Well, remember when I talked to the Monzi, they said there are winds there that happen that scare the hell out of them, and that's why they don't go there.
We're going to come back, Donnie. Final hour to go with you. We're going to open up the phone lines as well. The strangest story I've ever heard. We'll be back.